This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ebola has topped the news agenda over the past few weeks. President Obama pledged U.S. support to fight the disease and earlier today appointed what he calls an Ebola czar to manage the government's response. Certainly, the coverage has people worried. One poll shows more than a third of Americans think they or a family member will become infected in the next year. But is the narrative around dangerous disease in general causing a whole set of other problems? Well, we're going to talk with an author who thinks that that should be something we consider very closely. First, though, we're going to talk about the coverage itself. Washington Post Paul Farhi has written the initial coverage and about that coverage of Ebola. He's got an article called If the Media, in the article, I should say, he asks, you know, if the media had covered Ebola sooner, could the outbreak have been contained? Paul Farhi, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So could it have been contained earlier? Should we have been on this story earlier?
I think there's a reasonable premise there. I think if the media had been sounding some more alarms, you'd be seeing some of the action that you just reported on with President Obama. You know, the government does respond to media publicity, and it may have well have been the case that if we had been on this story in an intense way, certainly as intense as we are now, if we had been there, you know, 3-4 months ago, maybe we wouldn't be hearing much about Ebola right now because the outbreak would have been contained.
Well, contained, or perhaps somewhere not contained necessarily, but in a place that doesn't necessarily affect us. I mean, my question to you is, how do you frame this story? Is this a story about an outbreak of a deadly disease causing pain and suffering to humans somewhere? Or is this a story about an infection that could affect Americans batten down the hatches?
Well,
it's become important to us.
Yeah, well, of course, the story became a story when it did affect Americans, when the two medical workers, one from North Carolina, came back to the U.S. You saw an enormous spike in the coverage. This was late July, early August, and it has continued since then. So when it was framed as something Americans could get, it suddenly became less exotic and more practical for people, and certainly the media responded that way.
What do you think has been the media response? I mean, obviously, it has taken on a sensational quality, but that may not be the media's fault. That may be how you read a story about a deadly disease for which there seems to be no relief.
There certainly are instances where you could say that is a sensationalizing of the story, but I would say that most people are consuming this information just in its totality as there's something that needs to be paid attention to. There's something troubling here. There's something that we should be alarmed about. And in other words, when you see it everywhere, when you hear about it everywhere, that's the story that you absorb. There's something important going on. Pay attention. And, of course, then there's the individual responses. What about my chances of getting this? What about my family? And that's when that takes over. But I'd focus less on any particular individual sensational story and look at the larger, you know, enormity of this story. People are responding to that.
But once it becomes an enormous story and once it is the water cooler conversation, then, of course, it becomes the responsibility almost of politicians and anyone in public life to weigh in on this and somehow pull the issue into their quarters. So, of course, who has had the best commentary on this but Jon Stewart?
If you've been paying attention to the news lately, you might have heard we're all going to die.
Ebola in America.
The very deadly and contagious virus may have spread.
The global fight against ISIS.
Warning of attacks in the U.S.
They intend to kill us.
Crisis on the border. Who is coming to America?
We have a border that is so porous, Ebola or ISIS or Ebola on the backs of ISIS could come through our border.
So, Paul, that gets us to sort of what's not the media's fault. It's what happens to the story, however you tell it, once it gets out into the public, right?
Yes, but Ebola is scary. Ebola is kind of a great white shark. Your chances of actually getting it are extremely low, but if you do encounter it, your chances of surviving are pretty low too. So there's plenty of reason to be concerned. And you know, we tend to be make it all about ourselves, but let's face it, this is a story about West Africa and potentially lots of other places in which people from West Africa could travel and infect others. So it's not unrealistic to worry about Ebola. I think in some sense what you're seeing is a kind of emotional dress rehearsal as filtered through the media for everyone to prepare for what could or might be something that is far more alarming than it actually is at this moment. But we need to prepare ourselves and think about the consequences of that moment.
And so then the question becomes whether preparation means protecting yourself from it or maybe understanding some of the deeper relationships that cause disease to form in the first place, that cause hot spots to form, and then the way it spreads because of our interconnectedness. And for that, we'd like to bring into the conversation now Priscilla Wald, who is the author of Contagious, Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak of Narrative, and the Outbreak Narrative, I should say. She's a professor at Duke as well. Priscilla, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you.
So what do you make of this? I mean, sort of the way we're telling the story, you frame this in terms of how we talk about contagion in general and in popular culture, the way we understand this issue.
Absolutely. And I would say I've seen a little more sensation maybe than I would like. And CNN called Ebola the ISIS of epidemics. Once people put those two things together, of course, that's what Jon Stewart is responding to, there's going to be a public reaction to the way that story is being told. And I agree that the coverage might have helped us address the issue, but you also have to think about how it's being covered and what language is being used and what it triggers in people.
But we have to use – I mean, that's our problem, isn't it? I mean, we have to use language. Language favors narrative. Narrative lends itself to metaphor, and metaphor can get us off the track pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
In fact, it can go viral.
Absolutely. But I think there are ways of telling the story that are very different from how we're doing it. So, you know, again, once you call Ebola the ISIS of epidemics, you're already in a different realm. At the same time, you know, how are we telling the story of the outbreak? Are we starting the story with, you know, this began in a remote place and has immediately, you know, has crossed borders and now threatens us? Or are we looking at a bigger picture and saying, what are the conditions that allow for that spread in the first place? Why are we not addressing those larger questions? Paul Farmer has asked this. Margaret Chan has asked this. A lot of economists are asking this. Why are we not addressing the issue of global poverty, which, after all, is the largest vector that turns an outbreak into an epidemic and an epidemic into a pandemic? And I think how we're telling that story affects how we see the problem and therefore how we address that problem.
But Paul, I can imagine if you tell your editor you want to talk about global poverty and some of the structural causes that allow this to become a vector and then spread globally, you're not going to get very far.
Well, I disagree with you. I would say that you don't need global poverty to spread disease. We have something called the flu in this country, which kills, you can make, there's various estimates, but several thousand people a year. And, you know, that is spread not through poverty, but through basic human contact. I am not denying the idea that poverty is a factor in containing an outbreak. But that is a secondary concern to the fact that there is an outbreak, and we should be aware of it, and we should cover it, and we should tell people, as we have in many cases quite responsibly, how to deal with it.
Priscilla, you, in your book, you take a look at kind of the formulaic plot lines, again, getting back to popular culture, the way we sort of the in pop culture perceive the whole notion of contagion.
Right. Absolutely. So what I look at is a film like Outbreak or more recently Soderbergh's Contagion. And in those films, you know, and I agree that while the outbreak is going on, there's a language of crisis that is inevitable and understandable. And people do have to be informed that there is a threat upon them. But how that language of crisis comes with how we should therefore address the disease while it's underway. Obviously, we need quarantine. We need to look at our border crossings. We need to think about vaccine and pharmaceuticals. But how about in between these outbreaks? How might we tell the story so that every time we mention epidemic or pandemic, an emerging infection, something like that, it doesn't immediately go into the language of crisis? And again, we look at that bigger picture.
Well,
and that's really the question I'm asking.
But it is a crisis. There is no question it's a crisis at this moment.
It's a crisis at this moment, but how about once it is contained? We're not talking about it at all. So we're only talking about it when it becomes a crisis. And what I'm suggesting, and this has been suggested by Margaret Chan of the World Health Organization, that, you know, why are we not addressing those larger issues so that we could have better access to healthcare and we could have better worldwide? And therefore, when an outbreak happens, it's much easier to contain and it doesn't become the crisis that we're facing right now.
Well, Paul, and I think you were about to complete that thought, so let me give you that chance.
Well, I mean, you know, we do need to talk about global poverty. There is no question it is an issue that has been with us. But, you know, the media, unfortunately, tends to operate on the here and now, and we lurch from crisis to crisis and often don't have the step back that we probably should, you know, need to address the conditions that create the crisis in the first place. But, you know, the news is what's happened yesterday, today, an hour ago, less so than what has been happening for centuries.
Sure. And that's and to be fair, Paul, we do in the media cover those questions. There's all kinds of reports in The New York Times and on NPR about poverty and its effects and how a disease or like Ebola can spread in a place like West Africa in a way that the flu is contained here and not lethal. And that's because of our, you know, robust medical system and our wealth here. It doesn't get to the point where it kills as many people as it does in West Africa.
Yes,
we do tell those stories, but they're in a different context.
That's a great point. I mean, once you get past saying what the basic facts are, there are a lot of stories that put the facts in context. And that context is the story of global poverty and rural health care and African health care, you know, in these countries. And it's a very troubling situation because the inability of these countries to deal with something like this.
So that gets to, you know, an even deeper thought, I would say, Priscilla, which is how we consume this news. You
right.
know, let's stop blaming NPR and The New York Times to a certain extent, because if you read about Ebola in West Africa and you don't care,
right.
and suddenly it shows up in your borders and you do care, and your concern is, how do I not get it? Then what you're not getting is how connected you are to the rest of that poor world. And if you don't fix that, you're going to get, if not Ebola, the next thing that comes along.
Absolutely. And going back to your question about popular culture, and I'd be very interested in Paul's response to this, when you have films like Outbreak and, excuse me, Contagion that show us, you know, this remote place where this problem has happened and how, you know, we stigmatize that place and we stigmatize the people from that place and then it gets into our cities and it's affecting us and so on. I think that that story that's being told in popular culture that's very dramatic and very sensational makes it more difficult for journalists to do a more to respond more rationally. And I think one of the reasons people are responding with the kind of hysteria that you're talking about has to do with how familiar that story is to us from popular culture. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, and I've been talking to journalists and they say, yes, I want to tell that story about how we shouldn't be immediately terrified and how we should be more humanitarian in our response. How do I tell it through this atmosphere of fear? So, Paul, I'd be really interested in your thoughts about that.
Why shouldn't there be fear, though? I mean, it is scary. You know, all of these movies play off our basic human reaction to the plague, you know, capital T, capital P. The reason they work on us is because we are afraid of the things that are out there. And so I'm not sure fear is a terrible human response in these cases. I don't think it should be sensationalized or exploited, but fear creates reactions, and reactions can also be very helpful and very useful. And in fact, we are seeing that. I mean, President Obama is committing military assets and, you know, Congress voting for $700+ million of aid. Those are all reactions, and those are all positive reactions.
I guess I would say that, you know, again, it depends on what kind of fear. What I'm seeing a lot of is panic. I'm seeing people avoiding I was reading about people avoiding an African restaurant in Minnesota, which is ridiculous. And that's the effect of panic. And I think respect for Ebola is critical. And perhaps in this case, because of what I'm calling the outbreak narrative, the opposite of panic for the World Health Organization and the CDC wasn't calm but complacency, and that's a problem too. But I think, you know, where is that middle ground between responding with hysteria and panic, responding irrationally, stigmatizing people in places, flooding the emergency room because you have a cold, or on the other hand, not going because you're scared when you need to, because you're afraid of what you're going to catch, or first responders not doing their jobs? Where do you draw, how do you steer in that middle ground between people who should respect and be informed about this disease versus escalating to that level of panic?
I would argue that there is very little panic. Avoiding an African restaurant in Minnesota is dumb, it's stupid, but it's hardly panic. Panic is people running in the streets. Panic is people doing the wrong things to protect their health. People are concerned. There's elevated awareness. But panic? I don't see any panic.
We're talking about response to the Ebola outbreak today on The State of Things. Paul Farhi is a reporter for The Washington Post. Priscilla Wald is an author and a professor at Duke University. Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's true. I mean, panic is in sort of the mind of the beholder to some extent. You have people taking advantage of it, right? Politicians who will conflate a deadly virus with an ongoing issue of immigration. And the problem is that fear has a way of shutting down or at least repressing our critical thought process. And so if I can get voters to think less critically and sneak in immigration along with Ebola and get them to think the two things are kind of conflated, that's not people running in the streets, but it might lead to sort of a deformed thought process.
Yeah, I think mainly what we're calling panic here is just really dumb and ill-informed stuff. And if I can plug my brethren in the media, that's where we come in to give you information that isn't sensationalized, that isn't going to create panic, but is going to frame this correctly and accurately and give you the information that you need to make an informed decision, not a bunch of dumb ones like avoiding restaurants and limiting immigration on the basis of Ebola.
And if we could get everybody to read The Washington Post from beginning to end and listen to NPR all day long, without the Joe, that The Washington Post contains a lot of good in-depth articles. They're not all on the front page, and they don't all have the big headlines. So, and our problem is such a small fraction of the public is reading the Washington Post and listening to NPR that they might go out and not go to a restaurant or conflate immigration with Ebola.
I also think what you just said, headlines. And right, headlines aren't necessarily what a reporter would choose for an article. And if I scan the headlines, I'm seeing words like apocalypse with an exclamation point. And I'm seeing words like bioterror. Can Ebola be weaponized? I mean, these are the things that I'm calling panic or overreaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be the case, overreaction by the media. It happens on virtually every story. That is our media culture these days. But to the public's credit, they are not running wild so far. And let's hope that they don't.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Paul Farhi, he's a reporter with The Washington Post. He's been writing about the media's coverage of Ebola. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Priscilla Wald is an author, the author of Contagious, Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. She's also a professor of English at Duke University. Thanks, Priscilla.
Thank you.
Coming up, the music of Nick Vandenberg. Stay with us on The State of Things.